Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Lucy had walked into Judy's barn dozens of times since she started working there 6 months before. But she had never felt so conflicted upon seeing the place. It was both the scene of her worst mistake and the source of this flickering sense of joy. She didn't trust either emotion. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Elizabeth Childs Shelburne about her debut, Holding On to Nothing. Set in a small mountain town in Tennessee, Shelburne describes an alcoholic young man who never had a reason to believe in himself, and a driven young woman who longs to escape but ruins her chances in a drunken moment in the backseat of a car. We've all heard that story before, but what happens afterwards is a heartbreaking tale of small actions leading to large consequences. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really am excited to be here.
So tell me, why did you dedicate this novel to the state of Tennessee?
Tennessee is just, it's my home. It's where I grew up. I grew up in East Tennessee in the mountains. And no matter how long I've been gone, it's still my home. When people ask me, where are you from? I answer Tennessee, even if they're just trying to arrange carpool pickup for my kids in Massachusetts. So it's just home. It really is.
Okay. And how did you come to write this particular story?
You know, I obviously grew up in, like I said, in East Tennessee, grew up sort of sitting on the front porch, listening to my dad tell stories a lot. He's a wonderful storyteller and wonderful reader. And my mom was a writer. And so I was just always brought up in this kind of storytelling tradition. And I always felt a little bit like I didn't see the East Tennessee that I knew reflected on the page. And I wanted to try to put that on the page, but really it wasn't sort of a thematic thing that got me there. It was, I'm really into books for the characters. I read for the characters. I write for the characters. And it's just sort of these two characters kind of came to me. Jephthah, you know, I just sort of knew he'd be this guy. I met a guy on the side of the road once named Jephthah, and he was much, much older than this Jephthah is. But, you know, it was 2 p.m. and he'd already been drinking and making bad decisions already for the day. And I wonder what that guy would have been like in his 20s. Again, you know, drinking, making bad choices. I knew there'd be guns around, if there'd be, you know, family dysfunction. And so I kind of started thinking about him. And then Lucy came to me with this line. She had a smile that made people feel safe, even though she never really felt that way. And I knew pretty instantly that she was someone who'd experienced a lot of loss in her life and was just sort of looking for a safe place to land and was just a really strong person. And so I knew if I could get these two in the same room, there would be a story there. And that's kind of how this story got started. That was the genesis of it. It's been through many, many drafts and has changed, you know, some along the way. But it's definitely, those are the two characters, the reason I got into it.
So when we meet Jephthah, well, throughout the book, he's struggling to be a better man. Did you want him to succeed?
I it's funny. In the beginning, Jephthah was not a point of view character. He was in the story, but he didn't have a perspective. And I started I had done a couple drafts from that angle, and due to some really great readers, they'd kind of nicely smacked me upside the head and said, you know, you really need to get Jephthah's perspective in there. And I was resistant at first, I think, because I was afraid of kind of writing that character that sort of comes from that family that everyone goes, oh no, you know, he's a tailor or a so-and-so, whatever the name is for whatever place you grew up in. I was a little scared because it's much easier to kind of keep him as a bad guy and a villain. It's much simpler. And once I started writing him, he got much more complex. And I kind of fell in love with him, to be honest. Not in a way where I'd like to marry him, but in a way where he became a really sympathetic character. And again, who really struggles. I wanted him throughout the book to work hard and to always be trying to be that better man, but he's an alcoholic and he never really had a good role model for what that might look like. And it's really hard to be a better man in those circumstances, but I always wanted him to try. And to, you know, for me, it was as much a surprise whether he was going to succeed or not, as it was to, you know, anybody reading it in the writing of it, sort of figuring out what was he, you know, was he going to make it or not?
Everyone in town knows that Jephthah's family, the Taylors, are just terrible people. Why are the Taylors so disparaged?
Well, I think they're like, again, I think this is the case, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's the case that, you know, we're probably no matter where you grow up, there's that family that, just everyone knows, you know, you kind of stay away from if you have half a choice. And they definitely fall into that category. You know, his grandfather is a drinker. His dad is a drinker. They've been arrested more times than anyone could count. Anytime there's a problem in town, you know, everyone's pretty sure a Taylor is going to be involved. And they're just, you know, and again, I think a lot of that, frankly, you know, boils down to just poverty and sort of the trauma people go through in their early childhood. And again, it's just really hard to make good choices and be a better man sometimes when your life has from the beginning been so hard. So I wanted to write a little bit about that and that struggle.
Lucy, your other protagonist, she's had a tough life, but she's filled with hopes and dreams. So did you know what her trajectory was going to be when you started out?
Hers, I did. I had a better sense of what she was going to do. And I knew Lucy was always, like I said, going to be someone who had experienced a lot of loss in her life, but that I had this vision of her always as this kind of scarred optimist that no matter what was going on, she really kind of maintained the possibility or believed in the possibility that that people could change, that they could be better. And that applies to herself too, right? That her life could change, that it could get better. She always believes that. And I love that idea of someone who had been through as much as she's been through and kind of continued to, again, continued to have those hopes and dreams, like you said.
Mm-hmm. The town they live in seems to represent small Southern towns all over the South, right? Was that based on real life experience, like Eastern Tennessee?
I mean, it's certainly inspired by it. It's definitely not based on any one place. The fun part about fiction is you get to kind of take, you know, the best or the worst, whatever you need for your purposes that day, and put them into a town. So, you know, I got to put the Walmart right next to the bar, which a freestanding bar still doesn't exist, in the town, where I had grown up for part of my life. So it's, you know, inspired by those places, but I like when I hear people say that it seems to, feel familiar, even if they're from, you know, a small town in Louisiana or North Carolina, or, you know, frankly, I had someone who had written me and said, you know, I'm from a small town in Canada and this feels so, so like my life and my home. And I just recognized it so much. So, you know, it makes me happy to hear that it's not just applicable to this one, you know, one little corner of Tennessee, but there's hopefully kind of the town is representative of small towns, maybe everywhere.
Well, I live in the city of Chicago and I'm from here also. So this is, it's not something I'm familiar with, but it seemed like, that there were stereotypical aspects of the Appalachian area, like alcoholism and guns and joblessness. So you're saying those are not stereotypes? That's true to form. Tell us about that.
I think sometimes Appalachia gets viewed through this kind of outsider lens, and that can feel sort of the things that are true that happen and are just kind of part of life growing up there can start to read like stereotypes. But the thing about stereotypes is that not always, but sometimes there is an element of truth to them. And those, you know, working at the Walmart is one of the biggest employers in small towns. And there are guns around and there is alcohol, you know, there's a lot of alcohol around. And I think those things, you know, can seem stereotypical, but they're also just true. And my hope was, you know, that if you were able to get into the character and to kind of dive underneath the stereotypes, they wouldn't feel like stereotypes anymore. They just feel like, you know, real people living real lives.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So since you mentioned her in the book, where does Dolly Parton fall on your list of favorite singers? Explain, and please explain the part about her being both country and mountain. Let's talk about the geography and Dolly Parton.
Yeah, I mean, Tennessee is a really long state. I'll start with that. If you drew a line on a map from where I grew up in East Tennessee to Memphis, that line would be longer than if you drew a line from where I grew up in East Tennessee to Canada. So Tennessee's really long. So it's very different, right? And I think East Tennessee is definitely part of the Appalachians. It's part of the mountains. It's not a flat space where you can grow a lot. It's tough to farm there. It's tough, you know, to live there. There's still a lot of poverty. And so I think that's part of what I was responding to, or that's what I was talking about when I was talking about the mountain versus country. And I, you know, I love Dolly. I think she is a national treasure. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I just think she is an incredible woman, an incredible singer. She does so much for the people of East Tennessee and beyond. Her Imagination Library has given away more than 100 million books because her father didn't read and she wanted to change that. And I just think that's an incredible story. You know, when you look at the people who were affected by the fires in Gatlinburg in 2016, she's given so much money towards them and towards supporting them and just has done so much for both East Tennessee, but beyond. She's really just a light, I think, in the world. I you know, I like to think of her as an angel.
That's awfully sweet. So Jephthah's parents are dead and he shares their land with his two siblings. What can you say about his brother and sister and how they treat Jephthah?
They are not nice people. Like, it's just true. They are not good people. And they're kind of fun to write because they are a bit more purely villainous. Deanna, his sister, especially. Bobby, I think, is probably more clueless. Deanna is definitely aware of everything she's doing and pretty mean about it. They don't have a ton of respect for Jephthah. He's their youngest brother. They've always looked down on him. And don't make any attempts to help him or help his life be better and share that land kind of unhappily, basically.
But his brother is shrewd and cunning and cheating.
His brother is those things, but I think it's really, it's Deanna who's kind of who's driving the boat on that one. So Bobby's
sister.
Yeah. Deanna, the sister. Bobby is involved in a lot of the execution, but Deanna is definitely the big idea person.
Mm-hmm. And she's been mean since she was a child.
Oh, she's just born that way.
A lot of fun scenes about how she behaves.
Thank you. I had fun writing her because, again, she's so purely evil. It's kind of, you know, there's something sort of delicious about it. You know, she's half a step away from cackling.
Yeah, yeah. But the whole business about the growing tobacco on their land, is that something that people could really do with the two brothers doing it with just a couple of hired hands?
Yeah, it is. I mean, they have a pretty big allotment. And so that would require, you know, a lot of work. It would require the whole family to kind of pitch in for sure. But they definitely also try to bring in as few people as possible because they want to try to keep as much as they can. Tobacco is definitely sort of heart, you know, back-breaking work. And their allotment's pretty big. And I did that on purpose. It's probably slightly larger than what you might see on the average farm. But, I wanted them to have a little bit, I wanted it to kind of have some money that would, you know, where they could actually make it and try to depend on that.
So then Lucy's parents are also gone, and she's been raised by her mother's best friend, who starts to feel a bit too controlling. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's funny. People sometimes have really polarizing reactions to Lou Ellen. She is very much loves Lucy, and really does want to try to help her, but doesn't always know the best way to love. Not that any of us do, but she sometimes struggles. And I think there's a line in the book about being loved by Lou Ellen could feel a little bit like being waterboarded by love. She's just very intense, and she wants so much to help Lucy, but also, you know, to help Lucy in the way that she thinks Lucy should be helped. She's not necessarily as interested in letting Lucy figure out her own way in life. She definitely thinks there's a way that Lucy should do things and wants her to do it that way. And previously, before the sort of inciting incident of the book, that had been fine because Lucy was just sort of, you know, on the path that she was on, and she's going to stay on that path. There wasn't a lot of friction there, but as the book opens and Lucy gets pregnant and has to decide kind of how to live her life with that and being pregnant, suddenly there's a lot more friction between her and Lou Ellen.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a character who's an outsider. That's Lucy's boss. Well, also Jephthah's boss when he performs with his band, but Lucy's boss at the bar. How is she different because of her outsider status?
Yeah, Judy is, I love her. She is one of my favorite kind of side small characters. Although she plays a big role in the book, she is sort of this kind of bartender with the wisdom. She's actually based on a real bartender named Judy who worked at a bar called the Cantab up here in Cambridge, where I spent every Tuesday night for about 4 years when I first moved up here, feeling sort of homesick and lonesome, and spent a lot of time sitting at Judy's bar, watching her exist in the world and kind of dismiss the people in the bar who were complaining loudly and talking a lot, but taking really good care of the people who were sort of sitting there quietly, you know, looking into their beer she had a way of kind of knowing who had actually suffered real loss in their life or, you know, really needed an ear. And I loved her. And it was nice to have her in the book because sometimes she could see some things that people that had grown up in this town could not. She could sometimes be a little bit of an outside voice and see a little bit where they could not. And sometimes she missed things too, because she didn't, you know, she doesn't know what it means to be a tailor or know about Lucy's parents being gone. And so there's things she misses by being an outsider, but there's a lot she sees that people from within the town cannot.
Mm-hmm. We touched on Walmart a little bit, but Walmart is like another important character in the story. Lucy works there, everyone shops there, and she's in the gun department because people buy more guns when the salespeople are cute.
Yes, pretty girls.
So what?
Was it.
Let's discuss.
I'll be honest and say I've not worked in the gun department at Walmart. So Walmart may come and find me and say, that's so wrong. But I kind of doubt it. I think it's probably the case that if you...
Okay.
If you want to make people feel protective, you should definitely put a pretty pregnant girl there in the gun department, and I bet they'll get a lot more protective real quick.
As long as she knows her stuff.
Yes. Yes. Right. You can't not. You got to know what you're talking about.
So there have been other books about the South, about small towns, about young girls getting pregnant by mistake, etc., about young girls choosing the wrong partner. So what makes your book different from all those other books?
I mean, I think the truth is, like, we're only ever telling a few stories anyway. So I think it's the case that, yes, that story's been told before, but yes, that story keeps happening. So for me, it was a chance to kind of explore that story in this specific town and this specific place with these specific characters. And with, you know, being able to put in lots of music was a really important piece for me to be able to include that in this town and this story so that it almost becomes a character too.
I want to talk about that. Let's talk about that next.
Yeah. I mean, I just grew up with a ton of music around, and I think it's funny. I didn't even growing up, didn't even know that I really liked country music or bluegrass music. And probably would have told you if you'd asked that I didn't, but then once I left and it wasn't the background to my life anymore, I realized how much I missed it. It was just always around. I didn't have to think about whether I liked it or not because it was always there. And once it was gone, I realized, oh gosh, I really do love this. So I wanted to have that in there and have that feeling of sort of music. And for me, it has always been something that I fall back on to kind of process my world and think about what's going on. And I knew for these characters, it would be that too. And I knew that Jephthah would have this, you know, I wanted him to have a couple of redeeming traits to look really bad on paper, but have a couple things that made him worth something. And the mandolin is one of those. He's a wonderful mandolin player and he loves it.
So if I were to ask you who, aside from Dolly Parton, are your top five country singers, who would you say?
That's a really good question. I really love some of the bluegrass musicians playing right now. I love Sam Bush. And there's an old group now, it's called Old and in the Way, but it had Jerry Garcia, David Grissom, and Tony Rice, who are incredible musicians playing. And I actually was just at the Dolly Parton show in Nashville 2-3 weekends ago. It was her 50th anniversary show at the Opry, and Lady Antebellum came on and played 3 or 4 songs, and they are
they're wonderful.
Good.
Yeah, they're good. Okay, you get two more.
Oh, two more. Oh my gosh. I am obsessed with Chris Stapleton. I just think his voice is absolutely stunning, and I could listen to him probably sing his grocery list, I think. And Sturgill Simpson also, those two.
Okay. That was just for me.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you so much. I've taken up a lot of your time, Elizabeth, so I'd like to ask one last question. What are you working on now? What's your next writing project?
I am actually working on a book. It's also set in East Tennessee, and one or two of the side characters from this book come back for that one. And it's about a woman named Alice who is a doctor. She's working in East Africa. She's a tuberculosis researcher. And due to some things that happen in Kenya, she'll kind of do anything to leave, including take over her father's medical practice in East Tennessee. But unbeknownst to her or to anyone else, there's a tuberculosis epidemic that's about to break out there. So it's sort of a different kind of literary pandemic thriller sort of, but it's been really fun and really fun to set there and a fun way to kind of look at some of the issues with healthcare that happen in small rural areas. It's sort of a fun way to look at that.
I will look forward to seeing that one. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was lovely talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much. This was great. Thank you.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host of New Books and Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Elizabeth Childs Shelburne, author of Holding On to Nothing. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.